Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. In recent years, it seems American politics has become increasingly bitter, and elections are increasingly close and hard-fought. And the question we'll be taking up this morning is why? Why is it that that is the case? And the answer seems to be that while on the national level, the two parties are very evenly divided in terms of their power and allegiance, and that means that elections can go either way, it has become much more important, if you want to understand American politics, to understand regional differences and the fact that in different parts of the country, different parties have power bases and are stronger. We'll be talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Earl Black. He is professor of political science at Rice University. That's in Houston. He is the co-author, along with his brother, Merle Black, who teaches politics and government at Emory. They are the co-authors of a recent book titled Divided America, The Ferocious Power Struggle in American Politics. The book has been out here now for a couple of months. It is published by Simon & Schuster. If you're interested in taking a close look at it, you can do that. It contains a lot of information and a lot of data about political affiliation in this country and how things have changed in the past few decades. We'll try to hit some of the main points, and then if you want to look at this much more closely, you can go out and you can take a look at the book. Professor Black, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's my pleasure to be here, David.
Just, again, to make this run through sort of basic points, the one, just to start out with, is that we have come, you make the argument, that we have come to a point now where, nationally speaking, party identification is really very close. I think maybe perhaps now the Republicans have just a tiny edge, but it's close enough to being 50-50 so that we are now at a point where, at least again nationally, in elections, it could very easily go one way or the other.
That's right, David. At the national level, through the 2004 presidential election, which is really the last election that we had available for this book, according to the exit polls from 2004, Democrats and Republican voters were basically tied across the nation. The Republicans had, for the first time, the slightest of edge, but it was under 40% for both the Democrats and the Republicans, and the rest of the voters are people who are independents or some other party. So what we have nationally are two competitive minority parties. From a historical standpoint, that's a pretty big Republican advance if we take a long historical sweep, because coming out of the New Deal in the 1930s, the Democrats had a huge advantage in party identification across the nation. So what's happened over time is that, at least through 2004, the big Democratic advantage from the past had declined, and the Republicans had become more competitive, but certainly had not established any national lead. Yeah. And since 2004, from the other polling that's been done in the nation, it seems as though the Republicans have lost some of the advantage from 2004. So I suspect today the Democrats would have become the leading minority party. But it would still be pretty even across the United States. Now, what has happened beyond that national pattern is that with the rise of the Republicans under the leadership of Ronald Reagan of California, starting with the 1980 presidential election, Ronald Reagan was the first Republican presidential candidate who really caused a major realignment of favoring the Republicans. But this realignment was not a national realignment. It's really been limited to the southern states, which were historically the old solid Democratic South, and the states of the Mountain Plains. And those two regions constitute, in national politics, the two Republican strongholds. The common denominator for that was a much more overtly conservative approach that has found its appeal primarily in the South and Mountain Plain states. The Democratic Party, which had a huge advantage before the 1980s, retains a tremendous advantage in the northeastern states and in the Pacific Coast states. And so we have, for the two major parties, they each have two regional strongholds, and together, in terms of size, they are pretty close together. Through 2004, in presidential politics, the fifth American region, which we identify as the Midwest, has been the critical swing region in American politics. Through 2004, neither party has been able to achieve a real advantage in the electorate in the Midwest. And so, from the standpoint of presidential politics, the closeness of the national outcomes has been the result of the Democrats doing very well in the Northeast Pacific Coast, Republicans doing very well in the South and the Mountain Plains, and then the critical battleground region has been the Midwest, and within the Midwest, the most important swing state has been Ohio. That's the state that's made the difference between winning and losing in the two most recent presidential elections.
So it's interesting that if you look at what has happened, say particularly in the last few decades, if you look for the big changes, the most dramatic change has been, if you look in terms of individual voters and their demographics, the big change has been the movement of white voters into the Republican Party, and then particularly the growth of Republicans in the South and the Mountain States. That's been the most dramatic thing that has happened.
That's right. And the transition of the South is particularly important because, you know, if you think back to the Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal, how did he win presidential landslides? How was he able to win four consecutive presidential elections? Well, the starting point for Roosevelt's easy presidential victories was a solid South. If he could carry the southern states, then he only needed about a third of the electoral vote outside the South in order to win. Well, Franklin Roosevelt, as a popular northern Democrat, you know, he could do that before breakfast, so to speak. So it gave the Democrats a huge advantage, and it was the only period in American politics where the Democratic Party won five straight presidential elections from 1932 through 1948, when Harry Truman was the Democratic candidate. What's happened since then in the South is that over the last half century, the South has developed a much, much larger middle class than it ever had before. And since the political culture of most Southern white voters stresses individualism, over time, that has represented an enormous opportunity for Republican development. The Southern whites remained more Democratic than Republican until Ronald Reagan came along. And Reagan especially was the great realigner for a lot of Southern whites. He made the Republican Party respectable for a lot of Southern whites who had been born and bred as Democrats. And part of the shift was that over time, as the National Democratic Party became associated more with liberalism, especially among Northern elected officials, and the Republican Party under Reagan was more identified with conservatism, that has really expedited the exodus of a lot of conservative white Democrats out of the Democratic Party and over into the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. So any Republican presidential strategy today generally begins with the South, because it's in terms of electoral college votes, it's the largest of these five regions in the United States.
This, I think, you also point to something which is interesting, and something that I'm sure will not really surprise people in terms of trends, and that is that, again, over the last 50 years or so, roughly speaking, that the Republican Party and Republicans have become more conservative, and that the Democratic Party and Democrats have become more liberal. So here we, ideologically speaking, the gulf between the two parties has has widened.
That's
what
correct.
And I guess again one of my questions, and I think it's a pretty interesting one. I'm not sure if there's a real good answer, but that is, what has happened to the moderates? Where did there seems to be no mid ground anymore.
Well, the thing to keep in mind about moderates, and a lot of times people talk about the power struggle between liberals and conservatives, and sort of look to moderates as a way to restore a center in American politics. The problem is that most of the moderates, most of the people who call themselves moderates in American politics, are also partisans. They're either moderate Democrats or moderate Republicans. And there are very few, relatively speaking, moderate independents. That's about 10, 12, 13, 14% of the entire electorate. So sometimes people, you know, talk about possible third party based on moderates. That would be pretty hard to actually put together. And what's happened, I think, in both parties is that both in the electorates and among elected officials, but probably especially among elected officials, now it's much harder to have a national career as a Democrat unless you're fairly liberal, particularly if you aspire to the presidency. And for the Republicans, it's pretty hard to have a national career unless you're conservative, at least on a number of issues. So what this does, I think, is make it difficult for either party to come forward with presidential candidates who have a very strong appeal that goes beyond partisans. And that really creates a situation where, with their close national elections, winners don't win by much, and losers can always think that they're one issue away from winning. And that just creates a dynamic in which the ideological power struggle that just played out on every issue, every wave in the political ocean becomes contested. And that I think, just creates a dynamic where everybody gets up in the morning among most of the prominent national politicians and set out to settle the scores within the last 24 hours of the news cycle.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Earl Black. He's professor of political science at Rice University. That's in Houston. He is the co-author, along with his brother, Merle Black, who is professor of politics and government at Emory in Atlanta. They're the co-authors of a recent book, Divided America, The Ferocious Power Struggle in American Politics. That's the subtitle, and it's published by Simon & Schuster, and takes a look at partisan identification in this country, what's happened with that over, roughly speaking, over the last 50 years. And particularly, they make the argument that if you're going to understand American politics, you really have to understand the fact that it's now has become much more regional, and that is that you might even, I don't know if it's oversimplification, but you might even be able to say, I can tell you how people are going to feel about particular issues based on where they live. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Something you talked a little bit about how the big change has been the movement of white voters into the Republican Party, and also the growth of numbers of Republicans in the South and in the plains and mountain states. Something else in terms of something that just hasn't changed and has been remarkably stable over time has been the identification of African American voters as Democrats.
That's correct. That's the most important continuity in American politics from the early 1960s to the present. By overwhelming majorities, African Americans have identified with the Democratic Party. That's been true in every part of the United States. The main difference in the impact of African American voters is the size of that group among all voters varies considerably from one part of the region of the nation to the next. So what we have today, and one of the trends that we really establish in the book, particularly in the last chapter of the book, is to show how dramatically the parties have changed among voters in terms of the basic demographic groups that are out there. Back in the 1950s, large majorities of voters in both the Republican and Democratic Party were white Christians. That was using the survey polls that go back to the 50s. That's established very clearly, because that was the vast majority of all people who voted in the United States. Now, in the last 50 years, the United States has become incredibly more diverse than at any previous point in its political history. And so now, today, what we have in our party system is a much greater concentration of different voting groups in the two parties. And the most dramatic change has taken place within the Democratic Party. In the Democratic Party, as of the early 2000s, about half of all voters who call themselves Democrats are now the combination of all minorities: African Americans, Hispanics, Latinos, other non-white minorities, plus all non-Christian whites. That is a group now that cast half the vote of the Democrats in 2004. White Christians were down to half of all Democrats. Well, white Christians remain a very large majority of all Republicans. So what we have now, and this is one of the reasons why it's so difficult to reach compromises in the political system, is we have parties that are much more demographically different than at any previous point in our history. That means that the interest, the values, the things that groups want is now much more different than has been the case in the past. And as a result, it's very hard to achieve public policy that really goes beyond partisan interests and wishes. And so we get in our party politics now, when you combine that with close recent national elections, we have a situation where what we call, in divided America, the ferocious power struggle just perpetuates itself. And I think that's likely to be the case for as far ahead as we can see. It's very much more difficult for presidents of either party to now enunciate public policies that will have really broad appeal. That becomes, and the bottom line is, the United States now becomes much more difficult to govern than perhaps in the past.
Let's bring a caller into the conversation. We do have someone here who would like to join us in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm interested in your topic here. I don't challenge a lot of what you have to say about how we've become more polarized. The only thing that I really kind of question is your characterization of current Democrats as being more liberal. I think in comparison to liberal or progressive parties in other countries, our Democrats could hardly be described as being particularly liberal. They actually seem to me to be very moderate, and the Republicans have become more conservative. It's hard to find anybody like Nelson Rockefeller in the Republican Party anymore. But there are many, very moderate or even fairly conservative Democrats. So the whole thing seems to have really shifted downward towards moderate and conservative, with very little real liberal leanings within either of the political parties.
And I think the liberalism and the conservatism, it comes out most clearly from elected politicians, particularly those who rise to leadership positions in the House and the Senate, or who become active in presidential campaigns. Now, on the Democratic side, particularly in the South, that was where, by historical standards, there used to be a large proportion of moderate to conservative Democrats in the South. That the conservative Democrats have now, according to the exit polls, have almost vanished. That is, the conservative white Democrats in the South who are left are basically pretty elderly.
Well, I guess I'm questioning mm-hmm. how we're defining conservative, and if they're no longer defining themselves conservative because they are not as conservative as somebody else, that's perfectly acceptable. But whether they're actually conservative or actually liberal, I think they are actually, the Republican Party is actually very conservative, almost reactionary in some of its positions. But I don't think that the Democrats are particularly liberal. I think the whole thing has really shifted to be, in general, much more, a conservative position. And there isn't much of a, there's, as I say, very few moderate people like Nelson Rockefeller, who, was within the Republican Party. And there are really, it's hard to think of, if you compare them with, people in other countries who are described as liberals, the positions of, what they're actually trying to get the government to do seems to be very moderate.
Well, I think for trying to understand American politics, the exit polls now ask voters to self-classify themselves, and the trend over time across the nation has been for a much higher percentage of America's liberals to call themselves Democrats, and for an even higher percentage of America's conservatives to call themselves Republicans. So at least by historical standards, the parties are more distinct ideologically than at any previous point in American history, according to the exit polls, through 2004. And again, that's the last presidential election that was available for us to examine here. Among white voters in the United States, the moderates were basically pretty much evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. But the central tendency in both parties is, particularly when you combine white liberals in the Democratic Party with minority voters, African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, others, then the basic pattern in the electorate for the Democrats is a party that is much more liberal by American standards than at any previous point in the past. And by the same token, the Republican Party is much more conservative in the past. And your point about Nelson Rockefeller is certainly true. There's no way in which a Nelson Rockefeller today, someone like that, could be effectively competitive in Republican national politics.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have somebody else I want to get onto here. Just very quickly, as we have said, one of the biggest stories in American politics in the post-war era has been the movement of white voters into the Republican Party, particularly in the South. And the other thing in terms of continuity, that as we've discussed, the one thing that has not changed is the fact that African-American voters identify overwhelmingly as Democrats and have since the 50s. One thing, you also look at another block, which is essentially it's Latinos and Asians. And there we see, while still these folks that you call new minorities are still mostly Democrats, like 49% of them are Democrats, the number of Republicans has climbed. And that gap has narrowed considerably since the mid-70s. Do you think that there is a greater possibility for more significant growth, that is, movement into the Republican Party of Latinos and Asian Americans?
I think right now, particularly coming after the recent immigration issue, the attempt to pass immigration legislation that failed at the national level, I think the impact of that is going to move Latinos more in a pro-democratic direction than they have been in the past, and if that is the case, then that's going to make the Democrats certainly going to put them in a more competitive position in a number of states where the changing demographics is one in which the Democrats are hoping to take advantage of the new minorities to combine with African Americans and white Democrats to be very competitive.
We have as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Earl Black. He's professor of political science at Rice University. He is the co-author of the book Divided America, The Ferocious Power Struggle in American Politics. It takes a look at what's happened with partisan identification here in the United States over the last few decades and how he and his co-author, Merle Black, his brother, who teaches at Emory in Atlanta, they make this argument that if you're really going to understand American politics, you have to understand regional divisions and the fact that increasingly certain parts of the country have tended to identify very strongly one way or another as Democrat or Republican. And then, of course, the maybe one of the interesting places is the Midwest, because there the numbers of Republicans and Democrats are pretty evenly divided. And that's why we are here in a region that is considered one that can go one way or another. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone next in Gibson City. This is line two.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I just want to say I agree with the previous caller. I think both the Republicans and Democrats have moved to the right. And the reason why I say that is of the new elections this last time around, and if we had a more liberal Democratic Party, I think we would be pulling out of Iraq right now. And I'll just hang up and listen to what you have to say. Thank you.
You know, part of the dynamic that produces this very close national battle has to do with especially the importance of winning the presidency. And the Democrats came very close in 2004 to winning the White House. If the Democrats had carried Ohio, John Kerry would have been elected president. And in 2000, if Al Gore had carried his home state of Tennessee, he would have been elected president as well. So for what we have is a situation where it's very unlike the 1980s. In the 1980s, the Republicans won three consecutive landslide elections in the Electoral College. Ronald Reagan in 1980, again in 1984, and then George Herbert Walker Bush in 1988. Well, the most important development of recent presidential politics is that the Republicans, with this very conservative strategy, have really lost the capacity to create these national electoral college majorities. In fact, in the last two presidential elections, the only large urban industrial state outside the South that the Republicans were able to carry was Ohio. States that Ronald Reagan had carried easily back in the 80s, now they've become very Democratic. California is the best example. That used to be a state that was Republican. Starting in 1992, it became Democratic, and it's going to be Democratic as far ahead as the eye can see. So what we have now is a situation where the Democrats are on the verge of winning presidential elections since 2004. President Bush's unpopularity has increased. The Iraq War would certainly be the main reason for that. And so, looking ahead to 2008, the Democrats have a huge lead. It would be very much of a surprise if the Democrats failed to win the presidency in 2008. And in order for the Democrats to do that, all they really have to do is to keep doing what they've been doing in the last two presidential elections, which is to sweep the Northeast, sweep the Pacific Coast states, except for Alaska, which only has three electoral votes, and then do a little bit better in the Midwest. And all they really need to do is to carry the upper states in the Midwest that they have been carrying, states like Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, and add, at a minimum, Ohio and or Missouri, and then pick off targets in the mountain plains where growing Hispanic mobilization might well create a Democratic majority, states like New Mexico, Colorado, perhaps others, and then try to be competitive in selected southern states like Florida, which would be the other major state. So on paper, the Democrats look like they are certainly in a position to put together a national ticket that is winnable. All of the Democratic candidates are people who, for the most part, come out of the liberal wing of the National Democratic Party. None of the Democrats running right now are running the way Bill Clinton ran back in 1992. If you recall back then, Clinton, as the governor of Arkansas, was running as a politician who mixed things up ideologically. He wanted to. He talked about raising taxes on the wealthy, but he also talked about reforming welfare. He took a strong position in favor of the death penalty back in the Democratic primary. He mixed things up ideologically. Right now, the main Democratic candidates are really not running in that tradition, it's because, particularly among Democratic primary voters, there's where you would find liberals as a much larger component of strong Democrats likely to turn out in primaries than even in the general election. So that forces the Democrats to the left, just as it forces the Republicans to take very conservative positions, at least on a lot of issues.
All right. Well, let's talk again with another caller. We have somebody who obviously must be on the road, calling on a cell phone, I'm guessing, here on line number 4. Our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, two questions. I wonder if the guy there has a comment on the latest Pew Research study that came out that on issue after issue seems to point that the vast majority of the American people are well to the left of either political party, whatever left might mean. And my other comment was that this whole liberal conservative thing, I think most Americans find very frustrating that they have to except for one of the other of those categories for themselves, because I think it kind of goes hand in hand with you must declare yourself a Democrat or a Republican. And I think most people are sick of both the parties for the very reason that they have to plug themselves into this cookie cutter sort of style. If you're this, then you must be for this, and you must be for that. And frankly, I prefer a parliamentary type of government like Europe, where you could vote for somebody who actually represented your views instead of somebody who maybe did on some of the issues and was totally against you on something else. I think in the end, they both these parties, as we all know, just represent the money that feeds them and not us. That's my only comment.
All right. Well, I thank you for the comment, Professor Black. Can you reflect on any or all of that?
Yeah, I think a lot of polling that's done of the general public, and not necessarily refined down to actual voters, will certainly find more support for programs that come out of a liberal agenda than would be the case among people who have actually voted at least through 2004. So part of the problem for party out of power is to mobilize some of those people who share policy views but haven't actually voted. The basic way that we have to analyze American politics comes out of the questions that are asked really on the exit polls, and it's on those polls that is, you know, as rough and ready as they are, at least asking questions about voters, about their partisanship, and about their ideology, does give us a way to think about the broad patterns in American politics. See, what we have in the United States in recent times is, because of our divided national policy, we've had the Republicans in a position recently until 2006, to control the presidency and both houses of Congress. That had been something that Ronald Reagan never achieved back during his time. But starting in 1994, when the Republicans won the House and the Senate 2 years into Bill Clinton's presidency, Republicans had control of the Congress most of the time, House all the time. And then starting in 2000, Republicans added the president. So until 2006, we've had a situation where the Republicans have been the governing power in both the executive and legislative branch. And the net effect of that is pursuing conservative policies that have their greatest support in only two regions of the country, the South and the Mountain Plains, over time, the Republicans created resistance to a lot of their policies, and that resulted in the House victories in for the Democrats, the House and Senate victories in 2006. Now, if in fact the Democrats regain the presidency in 2008 and keep Congress, both houses, which I think would be the most likely outcome, then we'll have a situation where, judging from the Democratic field today, whoever becomes the Democratic nominee is going to be under pressure from party elites to govern in a much more liberal direction than even Bill Clinton did back in the 1990s. And so that would be a test, really, to see whether or not a liberal agenda where a Democratic president leads a Democratic House and Senate can successfully govern. That would be the big challenge. That's a challenge that in our polarized politics really faces both parties. Conservatives over time have created opposition to the point where they lost control of the Congress in the last election, and the Democrats come back into power, then it'll be a tremendous opportunity for the Democrats to see if they can govern in ways that would be politically successful over time.
Let's talk again with another call. This is someone over in Indiana in Terre Haute, line number one. Hello.
Hi there, my question has to do with the Electoral College and the fact you're talking about the Midwestern states and how they can go one way or the other. I know our theory is one man, one vote, but when it comes down to it, is there a reason that all of our electoral votes go toward one party as opposed to splitting them up on some kind of a percentage basis to go more toward the one man, one vote reasoning?
That's a very interesting question. Now, and a lot of voters, I think, don't understand the Electoral College. The Electoral College that's in the Constitution simply decides how many electoral votes each state will have. It does not tell the states how those electoral votes will be cast. And so the winner-takes-all tradition, which practically every state, there might be one or two exceptions, still follows, that winner-take-all tradition where if you carry Florida by 300 votes, you get all of Florida's electoral votes, and so forth. That is not in the Constitution. That could be changed overnight by action of state legislatures.
Is there a reason that they've maintained that?
The reason was that came into being back in the 1830s, and the reason it came into being was states wanted to say, how can we get one of our people into the next cabinet? Well, let's maximize our contribution to victory by changing our election laws to say that whoever carries our state gets all of our electoral votes. And then, if we succeed, we've got some leverage against the president to get one of our friends into, the cabinet. And once the bigger states started to do that, all the smaller states just started along. So that's a tradition that now goes back to the 1830s. But
is there a chance that will ever change?
If states wanted to change, think about California. Until 1992, California was a state that had been safely Republican in every presidential election from the 1950s until 1992, with a single exception of 1964. In every other presidential election, all of California's electoral votes had been given to the Republican Party. Well, now the Democrats, starting in 1992, can make California a safe state. So I think it'd be unreasonable to expect that the Democrats in the California legislature say, well, now we've finally achieved our objective, we can give all 55 of California's electoral votes to a Democrat. Likelihood is they're not going to try to change state law to divide that up. So that's the incentive that becomes very perverse. And that's the reason why reform is very unlikely.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd like to just quickly, again, introduce our guest, Earl Black. He's professor of political science at Rice University, and he is the co-author of the book Divided America, The Ferocious Power Struggle in American Politics, which takes a look at how it is that voting patterns or partisan identification breaks down demographically, how individuals identify and how that's changed over time, and then how regions of the country tend to identify, and also how that has changed over time and what that means for national politics. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Geneva. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a crisis in this country, and we're in a time when I've never seen this country so bad off. And I've been voting since 74 or 75. I can't understand it's why these politicians, for some reason, can't get together and work things out. It's not about the public good anymore. It's about what kind of money or what are you going to do for me. I mean, it's gotten to the point where everybody's going to start, and I see this trend going down the middle. I've never seen so many people in my life so disgusted with the left and the right that, I mean, I actually went from being Republican to being independent. Why? Because my Republican Party is in the state, has let me down. Every time you write them a question, ask them a question, or, you know, get an information out, you don't receive anything from them. You know, and what have you done for me lately? You know, nothing. Now, this is in big government. You know, they tell us here that we have to be saving, you know, that all the big, you know, financial gurus say you have to be saving, putting more money into your savings account and your IRAs. But you know what? Guess what, guys? I don't have the money anymore. I'm middle income, and I'm being forced out by property taxes, by income taxes. I'm paying for somebody else's crap, excuse my French, but what it comes down to is the American public has had it. And until politics gets rid of two-family system, which we've got the Clintons and the Bushes running it for the last, 20 years, I think it's about time they start listening to the average Joe like myself. I make an honest wage. I pay for all these guys' salaries to be there. We vote them in. And they always tell us they're going to do this for, you know, they're going to take care of the Social Security system. They're going to take care of the education. They're going to, you know, do they ever do it? I've been hearing the Social Security problem for 30 years.
Yeah. I appreciate the comments of the caller, and I want to hear what Professor Black, what you've got to say, as I think that the caller echoes the kind of frustration that a lot of people have now with the Congress. Not only are we told recently that the president's, his approval ratings have been poor for a long time, but recent surveys show that people actually aren't really very happy with Congress either. And I think it goes to the very kind of point that the caller makes, that people feel that there's much too much partisan rancor, and that as a result, we get gridlock and nothing ever gets done.
Well, that's why we wrote Divided America. and I would think that what we try to do in this book is to try to help people understand why the nation is at this impasse where frustration abounds. Now, frustration abounds on all sides. The caller is reflecting the frustration of somebody who had identified with the Republican Party and now is frustrated by their failure to address the issues that are important to him. That's a common frustration on the side of winners, because even when a party like the Republicans wins the White House, even if it achieves control of the House and the Senate, frequently, that's nominal control. It's not large enough majority. It's not New Deal-sized majorities where Franklin Roosevelt can pass a program because he's looking at huge majorities for his programs in both the House and the Senate. No party in recent times has been able to achieve those kinds of majorities. The frustration is also very prominent among the losers because they're getting even less. And the result is, under our current conditions, because we have this divided political system where the regions are very important and where the parties are very, very different from the past, it is a sad but unfortunate reality of our system that very few parties are likely to be in a position to truly implement programs that would appeal to their partisans and to the independents who prefer them or prefer specific candidates. The result is, it's a reason why the subtitle of the book is The Ferocious Power Struggle in American Politics, because we have a situation where neither party is truly a majority party in terms of voters. Parties have their bases in these different regions. And if I might just add one thing about the impact of the 2006 House elections, the biggest change, the most important regional change that came out of the 2006 congressional elections was that the Democratic Party radically increased its share of House seats in the Northeast. The electorate of the Northeast had been pro-Democratic, but the Democrats had not, before 2006, really been able to capitalize fully on that advantage. That's what they did in 2006. And because of that, now in the current House of Representatives, the Democrats get more in terms of a surplus out of the Northeast than the Republicans are now getting from the South. That's a big, big shift. And if the Democrats can hold the Northeast at the very high levels that they have, they're going to be in a very strong position in House elections for some time to come.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. I have one more person here in a couple of minutes left. We'll come back to Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm a political geographer here at Illinois, and it's a very interesting discussion. And I think my question speaks to several of the other callers that have been calling recently, expressing their frustrations with the direction that our party system has gone in the United States. The question is this, is Dr. Black, you've been discussing these regional shifts in U.S. politics from a very domestic, largely individual voter perspective. So I was wondering, though, if you could talk about the other side of this, and that is looking at the question of the regional shift from an international perspective in terms of how the U.S.'s political and economic position in the world has also had an impact on the regional tendencies of the various voters and the fates of the parties, if you will. So
that is a very interesting and very sophisticated question, and at this point you have reached the bounds of my knowledge. I'm sorry, but I don't feel competent to really venture into that, except to say that part of the reason why the Midwest is in great flux is because of the loss of employment in key Midwestern industries, automobile and so forth, that certainly or as a consequence of globalization, and that is one of the reasons why the Republican Party I think has not done well in the upper Great Lakes states in recent elections compared to what they did back in the 1980s. So it has, I think, contributed to making especially the Midwestern region one that is really up for grabs and represents right now, I think, a tremendous opportunity for Democratic gains in the coming years.
So you just, as a way of finishing up here in our last couple of minutes, do you think that the kind of the picture that you have laid out here, that we have been talking about, is this likely to describe American politics now for the foreseeable future?
Well, politics is give and take. Politics is always changing. I think it offers a way to get what we have frequently in American politics is we just analyze the nation, and that doesn't give you a sense of what's underneath it. Or we talk about South versus North, and the North's too big and complicated to do that. So what we tried to do in this book is to really help readers understand by dividing the North into four regions, Northeast, Midwest, Mountain Plains, Pacific Coast, and see the different dynamics there. I think that becomes a good way to start to understand the big picture of American politics. Otherwise, you're left with trying to analyze trends in 50 states, and that there's too many to make any sense out of that.
Well, and if the Democrats should recapture the White House, House and maintain control in Congress. Now, then we get to a situation where we no longer have divided government. Theoretically, that means that the president and the Congress will be on the same page, and it may be more likely to advance an agenda. But that also, you have, I guess, have to go back to asking the question, well, or speculating on just what sort of control the Democrats will have in Congress. And if it still continues to be fairly close, then one wonders just whether they will be able to move their agenda, even if the president is a Democrat.
That's right. And, you know, one historical perspective is when Bill Clinton became president in 1992, by 1994, under his watch, I think largely because of the health care initiative, which ultimately didn't even come up for a vote in Congress, it was so divisive. The Democrats lost control of the Congress, and especially the House, on Clinton's watch 2 years in. It took President Bush 6 years of his presidency for him to lose control of a Republican Congress. So things can change, and since we're dealing with majorities that are hard to form in the House and the Senate, and especially in the Senate, are subject to filibuster on a large number of issues. Frequently, nominal majorities, even with the president's own parties, don't really add up to governing majorities. The key thing would be here to look at the size of the congressional majorities that Franklin Roosevelt had at the height of the New Deal, or that Lyndon Johnson had back after the 1964 election that enabled him to pass the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Medicare, etc. Those are very hard to achieve. Republicans have never come close to achieving those kinds of large majorities in the House and the Senate.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Professor Black, for talking with us. It's been very interesting.
Thank you, David.
And for people who would like to look more closely in detail at the kind of figures that we've talked about, you should look for the book. It's Divided America, The Ferocious Power Struggle in American Politics. It's published by Simon & Schuster. The authors are Earl Black, who's professor of political science at Rice University, and his brother, Merle Black. He is professor of politics and government at Emory University in Atlanta.